For it is drawn together and being drawn apart, say the more strenuous of these muses, while the gentler ones relax the claim that this is always so, and say instead that in turn the universe is at one time one and friendly under Aphrodite's power, and at another time many and at war with itself on account of some kind of strife. Now whether any of them has spoken truly or not in all this is a difficult and delicate question. It isn't right to find fault on such a scale with men so famous and so old, but there's one thing that can be said without giving offense.
What's that?
That they've looked down on the likes of us, the many, and paid us far too little regard. They give no thought at all to whether we follow what they're saying or get left behind, and each of them simply carries through to the end whatever he's set out to say.
What do you mean?
Whenever one of them declares that things are, or have come to be, or are coming to be, many are one or two, and then again speaks of hot mixed together with cold, positing separations and combinations elsewhere. Tell me, Theaetetus, in the name of the gods, do you actually understand each time what they mean by these things? As for me, when I was younger, I thought I understood exactly what was meant by what is not, which is actually the very question we're now stuck on. But now you see what a difficulty we're in about it.
I see.
So perhaps we're in just as much the same condition in our souls regarding that which is, thinking we're comfortable with it and understand it whenever someone utters the word, while with that which is not we don't, when in fact we're in exactly the same state with both.
Perhaps.
And let's say the same holds for the other terms we mentioned earlier.
Absolutely.
We'll look into the rest of them later if it seems good to do so, but for now we must examine the greatest and most fundamental one first.
Which one do you mean? Or is it obvious that you think we should investigate first what people mean when they say that which is?
You followed right on my heels, Theaetetus. What I mean is that we should proceed in this way, as though they themselves were present, we should question them like this. Come now, all of you who say that everything is hot and cold or some other such pair, what is it you mean when you speak of both of them, saying that each of the two is and both of them are? What are we to understand by this being of yours? Is it a third thing alongside those two, so that we should count the universe as three things according to you and no longer two? Surely, in calling one of the two being, you don't mean that both of them equally are, for in either case there'd be one thing, not two.
True.
But then do you want to call the pair of them together being?
Perhaps.
But then, my friends, we shall say, even on this view the two would most clearly be spoken of as one.
Quite right.
Well then, since we're at a loss, you must make it clear enough to us what you mean to signify when you utter the word being. For clearly you've understood this all along, while we used to think we did, but now find ourselves at a loss. So first teach us this very point, so that we don't imagine we understand what you're saying when the truth is quite the opposite. Now, in saying this and demanding it of them, and of everyone else who says that the universe is more than one thing, are we, my boy, going to be doing anything out of line?
Not in the least.
Well then, shouldn't we also ask those who say the universe is one, as far as we're able, what exactly they mean by that which is?
Of course we should.
Then let them answer this. You say only one thing exists. Yes, we do say that, they'll answer. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Well then, do you call something being?
Yes.
Is it the very same thing as the one, so that you're using two names for the same thing, or how is it?
Well then, stranger, what's their answer to that going to be?
Clearly, Theaetetus, it isn't the easiest thing in the world for anyone who's adopted this hypothesis to answer that question, or indeed any other.
How so?
To admit that there are two names when one has posited that nothing exists but the one is, I think, ridiculous.
How could it not be?
And to accept from anyone at all the claim that there is such a thing as a name would make no sense either.
How so?
In positing that the name is different from the thing, he's speaking of two things.
Yes.
And what's more, if he takes the name to be the same as the thing, he'll be forced either to say it's the name of nothing, or, if he says it's the name of something, the result will be that the name is merely the name of a name, and of nothing else at all.
Just so.
And the one, too, will turn out to be the name of one thing, and also the name of the name of that oneness.
That's inevitable.
Well then, will they say that the whole is different from being, the one thing, or the same as it?
Of course they'll say it's the same, and indeed they do say so.
Well, if it's a whole, as Parmenides too says, like the mass of a well-rounded sphere on every side, evenly balanced from the center in every direction, for it must be neither at all greater nor at all smaller in this direction or that, if being is of that sort, then it has a middle and extremities, and if it has these, then surely it must have parts. Isn't that so?
It is.
But surely nothing prevents a thing that's been divided into parts from having the property of oneness as applied to all its parts together, and in that way being both a whole and one, being entirely.
Why not?
But is it not impossible for the thing that has this property to be itself, the one itself?
How so?
Surely what is truly one must, by the correct account, be said to be altogether without parts.
Yes, it must.
But a thing of the sort we described, being made up of many parts, won't agree with that whole account.
I follow.
Well then, is being to have this property of the one, and so be both one and a whole, or are we to say that being is not a whole at all?
You've set before me a hard choice.
What you say is perfectly true. For if being has this property of somehow being one, it will turn out not to be the same as the one, and so the sum of all things will turn out to be more than one.
Yes.
And further, if being is not a whole because it has this property imposed on it, while the whole itself exists in its own right, then it follows that being falls short of itself.
Quite so.
And by this account, being deprived of itself will turn out not to be being at all.
Just so.
And again, on this view, the sum of things becomes more than one, since being and the whole have each taken on a distinct nature of their own.
Yes.
But if the whole doesn't exist at all, then the very same consequences follow for being. Not only does it not exist, it could never even come to be an existing thing.
Why is that?
Whatever has come to be has always come to be as a whole. So that if one doesn't count the one or the whole among the things that are, one mustn't speak of either being or coming to be as really existing.
That certainly seems to be so.
And what's more, nothing that isn't a whole can have any quantity at all, for whatever quantity a thing has, that same quantity it must be as a whole.
Precisely so.
And so countless other difficulties without end will clearly turn up, one after another, for anyone who says that being is either some two things or one thing only.
What's coming into view even now shows that pretty well. Each difficulty links up to another, bringing a greater and harder confusion about whatever was said before.
Now we haven't gone through all those who argue with precision about being and not being, but let what we've covered be enough. We must now look at those who speak of it differently, so that from all of them together we may see that saying what being is turns out to be no easier than saying what not being is.
Then we must go after these others too.
And indeed, among them there seems to be a kind of battle of gods and giants going on, since they're at odds with each other over the question of what really exists.
How so?
Some of them drag everything down from the heavens and the unseen realm to earth, actually grabbing hold of rocks and oak trees with their bare hands. Laying hold of all things of this sort, they insist that only what offers resistance and can be touched really exists, since they define being and body as the very same thing, and if anyone says that something without a body exists, they despise the notion utterly and refuse to hear another word about it.
You're describing some formidable men. I myself have run into plenty of that sort already.
That's exactly why the people arguing against them defend themselves very cautiously, from somewhere up above, out of the unseen, insisting forcefully that true being consists of certain intelligible and bodiless forms. And as for the bodies of the other side and what they call the truth, they smash it to bits in their arguments, calling it, instead of real being, some kind of shifting process of coming to be. And in between these two camps, Theaetetus, an endless battle is always being waged over this very question.
True.
Well then, let's take an account from each of the two schools in turn, of the being they posit.
How shall we go about getting it.
From those who locate it in the forms, it will be easier, since they're more civilized. But from those who drag everything by force into body, it will be harder and perhaps nearly impossible. Still, this is how I think we ought to deal with them.
How?
Best of all, if it were somehow possible, would be to actually make them better in fact, but if that can't be managed, let's do it in speech, supposing them willing to answer in a more law-abiding way than they're actually willing to now. For an agreement reached among better people carries more weight than one reached among worse ones, and in any case it isn't these people we're concerned with, but the truth we're after.
Quite right.
Then ask them to imagine themselves made better, and answer for them yourself, interpreting what they'd say.
I'll do that.
Well then, let them say whether they claim there is such a thing as a mortal living creature.
Of course they do.
And don't they agree that this is an ensouled body?
Certainly.
Thereby counting soul as one of the things that are.
Yes.
Well then, don't they say one soul is just and another unjust, one wise and another foolish?
Of course.
And won't each of these come to be what it is through the possession and presence of justice, and its opposite through the presence of the opposite?
Yes, they'd agree to that too.
But surely they'll say that whatever is capable of coming to be present in something, or absent from it, is in every case something real.
They will say that.
So given that justice and wisdom and virtue generally exist, along with their opposites, and the soul in which they come to be, do they say any of these is visible and tangible, or that they're all invisible?
Pretty much none of them is visible.
And what about things of that sort? Do they say they possess any body?
Here they no longer answer all in the same way. They think the soul itself does possess some kind of body. But as for wisdom, and each of the other things you asked about, they're ashamed either to venture that none of these things are real, or to insist that everything is a body.
Clearly, Theaetetus, our men have grown more civilized. The ones actually sprung from the earth, born of dragon's teeth, wouldn't have been ashamed of a single one of those claims. They'd have stood their ground that whatever they can't squeeze in their fists is simply nothing at all.
That's more or less what they think, yes.
Then let's question them again. If they're willing to concede that even some small part of reality is bodiless, that's enough. For then they must say what it is that both these bodiless things and the bodily ones have in common, the thing they have in view when they call both of them being. Perhaps they'll be at a loss. If that's the sort of trouble they're in, see whether, if we offer it, they'd be willing to accept and agree that reality is something like this.
Like what? Tell me and we'll soon know.
I mean this, whatever possesses any power at all, either to affect anything else of whatever nature, or to be affected, even to the smallest degree, by the most trivial thing, and even on a single occasion, all that truly is. My proposal is that this marks the boundary defining what is real, nothing other than power.
Well, since they have nothing better to offer at the moment, they accept that.
Good, perhaps later something else will appear to us and to them. For now, then, let this stand as agreed between us and these people.
It stands.
Now let's go to the others, the friends of the forms. You must interpret their side of things for us as well.
I'll do that.
You people distinguish becoming from being and treat them separately, is that right?
Yes.
And you say that through the body, by means of perception, we have contact with becoming, while through reasoning, by means of the soul, we have contact with true being, which you say always remains the same in the same way, while becoming is now this way, now that.
Yes, that's what we say.
But this contact, best of men, what shall we say you mean by it in both cases? Isn't it just what we said a moment ago?
Which was?
Some affecting or being affected, arising from a power exercised between things that come together with one another. Perhaps, Theaetetus, you don't catch their answer to this, but I do, from long familiarity with it.
Then what argument do they give?
They don't grant us what we just said to the earth-born men about reality.
Which was?
We set it down as a sufficient boundary of things that are, that a power be present in something, whether to be affected or to act, even to the slightest degree.
Yes.
Well, against this, they say that becoming does have a share in the power to act and be affected, but that neither of these powers fits with being.
Isn't there something in that?
To which we must reply that we still need to learn from them more clearly whether they agree that the soul knows and that being is known.
Yes, they do say that.
Well then, do you say that knowing or being known is an acting or an undergoing or both, or is one of them an undergoing and the other something else, or does neither of them share in either at all?
Clearly neither shares in either. Otherwise, they'd be contradicting what they said before.
I follow, this much is clear. If knowing is a kind of acting, then what is known must in turn be undergoing something. So on this account, being, insofar as it is known by knowledge, is to that same extent being moved, through undergoing something, which we say could never happen to what is at rest.
Right.
But good heavens, shall we really so easily be persuaded that motion, life, soul, and thought have no place in that which fully is, that it neither lives nor thinks, but stands there solemn and holy, without mind, fixed and unmoving?
That would be a strange thing to concede, stranger.
But shall we say it is thought, yet not life?
How could that be?
Or shall we say both these are in it, yet deny that it has them in a soul?
How else could it possibly have them?
Or that it has mind and life and soul, yet stands there utterly unmoved for all its being alive?
All of that seems senseless to me.
Then what moves and motion itself must also be granted to be as things that are.
Of course.
And so it follows, Theaetetus, that if things were unmoving, mind would belong to no one about anything, anywhere.
Quite so.
And yet again, if we grant that everything is in motion and flux, by this same argument, we'll be removing this very thing from the realm of what is.
How so?
Does it seem to you that sameness, being in the same state and about the same thing, could ever come about apart from rest?
Not at all.
And again, without these, do you see how mind could exist, or come to exist, anywhere at all?
Hardly.
And yet we must fight with every argument we have against anyone who, by doing away with knowledge or thought or mind, insists on anything whatsoever.
Absolutely.
So it seems the philosopher who honors these things above all is bound, for this very reason, neither to accept from those who speak of the one, or of many forms, that the whole stands still, nor to listen at all to those who set what is in motion in every way, but, like a child praying for both at once, must say that being and the whole together are both what is unmoved and what is in motion.
Very true.
Well then, don't we now seem to have made a fair circuit of what is, in our argument?
We certainly do.
Ah, but Theaetetus, I think we're now about to discover just how baffling the inquiry into it really is.
How so? What do you mean by that?
My good man, don't you see that at this very moment we're in the deepest ignorance about it, even though we seem to ourselves to be saying something?
To me, at least. But just how we've fallen into this state without noticing, I don't quite understand.
Then let's look more closely and see whether, agreeing to what we now agree to, we wouldn't fairly be asked the very questions we ourselves once put to those who said the whole was hot and cold.
What questions? Remind me.
By all means, and I'll try to do it by questioning you, just as we questioned them then, so that we make some progress at the same time.
Good.
Well then, don't you say motion and rest are the most complete opposites of one another?
Of course.
And yet you say both of them equally are, and each of them is.
Yes, I do say that.
Do you mean when you grant that they are, that both of them and each of them are in motion?
Certainly not.
Or do you mean in saying both of them are, that they're at rest?
How could I mean that?
So you're positing being as some third thing over and above these, on the understanding that rest and motion are both embraced by it, and grasping them together, looking to their communion with being, you called both of them in that sense, are.
It really does look as though we're divining being to be some third thing, when we say motion and rest are.
Then being is not motion and rest taken together, but something else, distinct from both.
So it seems.
Then by its own nature, being neither rests nor moves.
More or less.
Where then must someone turn his thought who wants to establish something clear and certain about it in his own mind?
Where indeed?
I don't think there's any easy place left, for if a thing doesn't move, how is it not at rest? And what isn't at rest at all, how, again, is it not in motion? Yet being has now shown itself to us to be outside both of these. Is that even possible?
Nothing could be more impossible.
Then it's fair to recall this point as well.
What point?
That when we were asked to what we should apply the name not being, we were caught in utter perplexity. Do you remember?
Of course.
Well, are we now in any less perplexity about being?
To me, stranger, if it's even possible to say so, we seem to be in even more.
Let this then stand here as thoroughly perplexed. But since being and not being have come in for an equal share of difficulty, there's now some hope that as one of them comes to light more dimly or more clearly, the other will come to light in just the same way. And if we're able to see neither, then at least we'll push our account through between the two of them, in whatever way we can manage most gracefully.
Good.
Let's say then in what way it is that we call this same thing by many names on each occasion.
Like what? Give an example.
We speak of man, surely, while applying to him many further names, we attach colors to him, and shapes, and sizes, and vices, and virtues, and in all these, and countless others besides, we say not only that he is a man, but also that he is good, and countless other things. And in just the same way, on this same principle, having posited each thing as one, we turn around and speak of it as many, and by many names.
True.
And that, I think, is how we've prepared quite a feast for the young, and for those old men who take up learning late in life. For anyone can immediately seize on the objection that it's impossible for the many to be one and the one many, and they take delight, of course, in refusing to let us say a man is good, but insisting the good is good and the man is man. You run into people like this often enough, I think, Theaetetus, sometimes fairly old men, who through the poverty of their own understanding marvel at such things, and even imagine they've discovered in this some great piece of wisdom.
Quite so.
Well then, so that our argument may apply to everyone who has ever discussed being in any way at all, let what we're about to say now be addressed, in the form of a question, both to these people and to all the others we've conversed with before.
What is it?
Should we refuse to attach motion and rest to being or anything else to anything else, and instead treat them in our arguments as unmixable, incapable of sharing in one another? Or should we bring everything together into one as capable of association with each other? Or some things yes, others no, which of these, Theaetetus, shall we say they would choose?
I have no answer to give on their behalf.
Then why not answer point by point yourself, and examine what follows in each case?
Well said.
And let's have them say, if you like first, that nothing has any power of association with anything else for any purpose. In that case, won't motion and rest have no share in being at all?
No, indeed.
Well then, will either of them exist without partaking of being?
It will not.
Then by this agreement, everything has quickly been turned upside down, it seems, both those who set the whole universe in motion, and those who hold it fixed as one, and all who say that the things that are exist forever always the same in the same state according to their forms. For all of them attach being to their view, some saying things really are in motion, others that they really stand still.
Quite so.
And further, those who at one time compose all things and at another divide them, whether into one and out of one into infinitely many, or dividing into elements that are finite in number and composing out of those, whether they suppose this happens by turns or that it happens always, in all these cases they would be saying nothing at all if there is no mixture whatsoever.
Right.
And beyond that, the people who allow nothing to be addressed as other by association with a different affection would pursue their argument in the most laughable way of all.
How so?
Because they're forced to use, in speaking of everything, the words is and apart, and of the others and in itself, and countless other such terms, unable to keep away from them and refrain from linking them in their arguments, they need no one else to refute them. They carry their own enemy inside, as the saying goes, an opponent muttering within them wherever they go, like that absurd fellow Eurycles.
That's exactly right, and true too.
But what if we allow that all things have the power of association with one another?
That I can refute myself.
How?
Because motion itself would come to a complete stop, and rest in turn would itself be in motion, if each came to be present in the other.
But surely that by the strongest necessity is impossible, that motion should come to rest and rest be in motion.
Of course.
So only the third possibility remains.
Yes.
And indeed one of these must be so. Either all things mix, or none, or some are willing to combine and others not.
Of course.
And the first two have been found impossible.
Yes.
So anyone who wants to answer correctly will adopt the remaining one of the three.
Quite so.
Since some things, then, are willing to do this and others not, they're presumably in much the same condition as letters. Some of these don't fit together with each other, while others do.
Of course.
But the vowels, unlike the rest, run through all of them like a bond, so that without one of them, it's impossible for the others to fit together with each other either.
Very much so.
Now does everyone know which letters can combine with which, or does the person who means to do this properly need a skill?
A skill.
What skill?
The skill of grammar.
And what about high and low sounds? It the same there. The person who has the skill to recognize which sounds blend and which don't is a musician, while the one who doesn't understand this is unmusical.
Just so.
And we'll find similar things in the case of the other skills and non-skills.
Of course.
Well then, since we've also agreed that the kinds stand toward one another in the same way as regards mixing, isn't it necessary for anyone who means to show correctly which kinds harmonize with which, and which will not admit each other, to proceed through his arguments with some kind of knowledge? And also to know whether there are certain kinds that run through all of them, holding them together, so that they're capable of mixing, and again, in cases of division, whether there are other causes running through holes responsible for the dividing.
Of course, knowledge is needed, and probably the greatest kind of knowledge.
Then what shall we call this now, theetetus? Or, good heavens, have we stumbled unawares into the knowledge of free people, and are we in danger in our search for the sophist of having found the philosopher first?
What do you mean?
Won't we say that dividing things by kind, and neither taking the same form to be different, nor a different one to be the same, belongs to the science of dialectic?
Yes, we'll say that.
So whoever is capable of doing this discerns adequately one single form spread out through many things, each one lying apart from the others, and many forms differing from one another but embraced from outside by one form, and again one form connected as a unity throughout many wholes, and many forms marked off from one another, entirely separate. This is knowing how to distinguish, kind by kind, in what way each thing can associate and in what way it cannot.
Absolutely.
And surely you won't grant the power of dialectic to anyone, I imagine, except the one who philosophizes purely and justly.
How could one grant it to anyone else?
We'll find the philosopher, then, both now and later, if we look for him, in some such place as this, though he too is hard to see clearly, yet the difficulty in his case is of a different kind from that of the sophist.
How so?
The sophist escapes into the darkness of what is not, feeling his way about there by practice, and because the place is dark, he's hard to make out. Isn't that right?
It seems so.
But the philosopher, always attached through reasoning to the form of what is anything but easy to see, because of the brightness of the region, for the eyes of the soul of the many cannot bear to keep gazing steadily at what is divine.
That's likely to be no less true of him than of the other.
Well, we'll look into that more clearly later, perhaps, if we still care to, but as for the sophist, it's clear we mustn't let up until we've gotten a good enough look at him.
Well said.
Since we've agreed then that some of the kinds are willing to associate with one another and some not, and some to a small extent, others to a great extent, while still others run through all and there's nothing to prevent their associating with everything. Let's follow up on the argument next by considering not all the forms, so we don't get confused among a great many, but by picking out some of the ones called the greatest, first what sort of thing each of them is. And then how their power of association with one another stands, so that even if we can't grasp being and not being with complete clarity, at least we won't come away lacking any account of them, so far as the method of our present inquiry allows, if indeed it should turn out that we're permitted somehow to get off unpunished for saying that what is not really and truly is not being.
Well, we must.
Now the greatest of the kinds we've just gone through are being itself, and rest, and motion.
By far.
And we say that two of these are unmixable with each other.
Very much so.
But being is mixed with both, since presumably both of them are.
Of course.
So these become three.
Certainly.
And each of them is different from the other two, but the same as itself.
Just so.
Now what exactly do we mean this time by the same and the different? Are these two kinds distinct from the three, yet necessarily mixed with them always, so that we must consider five things rather than three as existing, or without noticing it, are we calling one of those three by the names, the same and the different?
Perhaps.
But surely motion and rest are neither the different nor the same.
How so?
Whatever we call by a term common to both motion and rest, that cannot be either one of them.
Why not?
Because then motion would come to rest, and rest in turn would be in motion. For whichever of the two the other became, it would force it to change over to the opposite of its own nature, since it would have come to share in the opposite.
Quite so.
Yet both of them do share in the same and the different.
Yes.
Then let's not say that motion is the same or the different, nor rest either.
No, let's not.
But then must we think of being and the same as one single thing?
Perhaps.
But if being and the same signify nothing different, then when we say that both motion and rest are, we'll thereby be calling them both the same, on the grounds that they exist.
But that's surely impossible.
Then it's impossible for the same and being to be one thing.
Pretty much.
Shall we then posit the same as a fourth form alongside the three?
By all means.
And what about the different? Must we call it a fifth, or should we think of this and being as two names applying to one kind?
Perhaps.
But I think you'll agree that among the things that are, some are said to be just what they are in themselves, while others are always spoken of in relation to other things.
Of course.
And the different is always relative to something different, isn't it?
Just so.
That wouldn't be so if being and the different weren't very far apart, but if the different partook of both forms the way being does, then there would at some point be something different that was different not in relation to anything different. Yet as it stands, it turns out for us that whatever is different is necessarily just what it is by being different from something.
You put it exactly as it stands.
Then we must say that the nature of the different is a fifth among the forms we're choosing to consider.
Yes.
And we'll say that it runs through all of them. For each one is different from the rest, not because of its own nature, but because it partakes of the character of the different.
Quite so.
Let's put it this way then, taking the five one by one.
How?
First, motion that it's entirely different from rest, or how else should we put it?
That's how.
So it is not rest.
Not at all.
Yet it is, because it partakes of being.
It is.
And again, motion is different from the same.
Pretty much.
So it is not the same.
No, indeed.
And yet it was the same, because everything partakes of that too.
Quite so.
We must agree then that motion is both the same and not the same, and not be troubled by that. For when we call it the same and not the same, we're not speaking in the same sense. Rather, when we call it the same, we say so because of its participation in the same in relation to itself. But when we call it not the same, that's due in turn to its association with the different, by which it's separated off from the same and has become not that, but something different, so that it's correctly called once again not the same.
Quite so.
And so, even if motion itself somehow partook of rest, there would be nothing strange in calling it stationary.
Perfectly right, provided we're going to grant that some of the kinds are willing to mix with one another, and others not.
And indeed we arrived at the proof of that point earlier, before the present ones, showing that this is how things stand by nature.
Of course.
Let's say it again, then. Motion is different from the different, just as it was other than the same and other than rest.
Necessarily.
So it is, in a sense, both not different and different, by the argument just given.
True.
Well, what follows from this? Shall we say it's different from three of the kinds, but not say so of the fourth, once we've agreed there are five that we set out to examine?
How could we? It's impossible to grant a smaller number than the one that's just come to light.
Shall we then contend fearlessly that motion is different from being?
Yes, quite fearlessly.
So it's clear, then, that motion really is both not being and being, since it partakes of being.
Perfectly clear.
So it's necessary that what is not exists in the case of motion and throughout all the kinds, for in every case the nature of the different, making each thing different from being, makes it not being, and will be right to say that in this same way all of them collectively are not being, and again, because they partake of being, that they are and have being.
That does seem to be the case.
So concerning each of the forms, there is much that is being, and an unlimited amount, in number, that is not being.
So it seems.
Then we must also say that being itself is different from everything else.
It must be.
And so being for us is not in just as many ways as there are other things. For those other things, not being it, are each one thing being itself, while the rest, unlimited in number, are in turn not that one thing.
Something like that, yes.
Well then, we shouldn't be troubled by this either, since the nature of the kinds does admit of association with one another. If someone won't grant this, let him first win over our earlier arguments, and only then try to win over what comes after.
That's perfectly fair.
Let's look at this too.
At what?
Whenever we speak of what is not, it seems we're not naming something opposite to what is, but only something different.
How do you mean?
For instance, when we say something is not large, does it seem to you that we're pointing more toward the small than toward the equal by that phrase?
Of course not.
So we won't agree that when a negation is spoken it signifies an opposite, only this much, that the not and the non placed in front of the words that follow point to something different from the things, or rather, different among the things that the names spoken after the negation refer to.
Absolutely.
Let's think about this too, if you agree.
What is it?
The nature of the different seems to me to be parceled out, just like knowledge.
How so?
Knowledge too is, I suppose, one thing, yet each part of it that applies to some particular subject gets marked off and acquires a name of its own. That's why there are said to be many arts and many branches of knowledge.
Quite so.
And the parts of the nature of the different, though it too is one, undergo this same thing.
Perhaps, but where are we going with this?
Is there some part of the different set over against the beautiful?
There is.
Shall we call it nameless, or does it have some name of its own?
It has one. Whatever we call not beautiful on any occasion is nothing but something different from the nature of the beautiful.
Now tell me this.
What?
Isn't it the case that the not beautiful turns out to be just this, something marked off from one particular kind among the things that are, and set over against some other one of the things that are?
Yes.
So the not beautiful turns out to be, it seems, a kind of opposition of one being to another being.
Quite right.
Well then, by this reasoning, is the beautiful any more one of the things that are, and the not beautiful any less?
Not at all.
So we must say that the not large and the large itself are, in the same way, both things that are.
In the same way.
And mustn't we set down the not just alongside the just on the very same footing, so that neither is any more a thing that is than the other?
Of course.
And we'll say the same of everything else, since the nature of the different has shown itself to be one of the things that are, and since it is, its parts too must be set down as being, no less than anything else.
How could it be otherwise?
So it seems that the opposition between the nature of a part of the different and the nature of being, when they're set over against each other, is, if we may put it this way, no less a form of being than being itself is. It doesn't signify the opposite of being, but only this much, something different from it.
That's perfectly clear.
Then what shall we call it?
Clearly this is just what is not, which we were hunting for on account of the sophist.
So is it, as you said, lacking in being no less than any of the others, and should we now boldly say that what is not firmly has its own nature, just as the large was large and the beautiful was beautiful, the not large was not large and the not beautiful was not beautiful, and in just the same way what is not was and is not being one form counted among the many things that are? Or do we still have some doubt about this, Theaetetus?
None at all.
Do you realize, then, that we've disobeyed Parmenides rather more thoroughly than his prohibition allowed?
How so?
He forbade us to investigate further than he did, and we've pressed on and shown him something beyond that.
How do you mean?
He says somewhere, for never shall this be forced through, that things that are not are, hold back your thought from this path of inquiry.
Yes, that's what he says.
But we haven't merely shown that the things that are not are, we've gone further and revealed just what form it is that what is not happens to be. For having shown that the nature of the different is a being, parceled out over all the things that are in relation to one another, we've dared to say that each part of it, set over against being, just is really and truly what is not.
And I think, stranger, what we've said is absolutely true.
So let no one accuse us of daring to say that what is not is, by declaring it, the opposite of being. We long ago gave up talk of anything opposite to being, whether or not such a thing exists, and whether or not it's even a coherent notion. But as for what we've now called not being, either someone must refute us and persuade us that we're wrong, or so long as he can't, he must say what we say. That the kinds mingle with one another and that being and the different, having passed through all things and through one another, mean that the different, by partaking of being, is through that participation, but is not that very thing it partakes of, only something different from it. And being different from being, it clearly must of necessity be what is not. And being in turn, having a share of the different, would be different from all the other kinds, and being different from every one of them, it is not any one of them, nor all of them together except itself. So that being beyond all dispute in countless ways is not, and likewise everything else, each taken separately and all taken together in many ways is, and in many ways is not.
True.
And if anyone doubts these very oppositions, let him look into it himself and come up with something better than what's been said now. But if he thinks he's found something difficult and enjoys dragging the argument now this way, now that, he's been laboring over something not worth much effort, as our present discussion shows. For that's neither clever nor hard to find. The other thing is what's both hard and fine.
What thing?
What was said before, to be able to let all this stand as granted, and then follow along, testing point by point, whenever someone claims that the different is somehow the same, or the same is different, in the very respect and manner in which he claims it undergoes this. But to show that the same is, in some loose way, different, and the different is the same, and the large is small, and the like is unlike, and to take delight in always producing such contraries in argument, that's no genuine refutation, but plainly, a newborn attempt by someone who has only just now laid hold of some one of the things that are.
Exactly so.
For indeed, my friend, to try to separate everything from everything else is, apart from anything else, tasteless, and altogether the mark of someone uncultured and unphilosophical.
How so?
To dissolve each thing away from everything else is the most complete abolition of all discourse whatsoever, for it's through the interweaving of the forms with one another that discourse has come to exist for us.
True.
So consider how timely it was just now that we fought against people who say such things and force them to allow that one thing may mingle with another.
Toward what end, though?
Toward the end that discourse should be for us one of the kinds among the things that are. For if we were deprived of this, we'd be deprived of the greatest thing, philosophy itself. And besides, right now we need to come to an agreement about what discourse actually is. If it had been taken from us entirely, we wouldn't be able to say anything at all anymore. And it would have been taken from us if we'd conceded that there's no mixing whatsoever of anything with anything.
That's right, but I haven't understood why we need to settle the question of discourse just now.
Well, perhaps you'll grasp it most easily if you follow along this way.
Which way?
What is not has turned out for us to be one particular kind among the others, scattered throughout all the things that are.
Just so.
So the next thing to examine is whether it mingles with belief and with discourse.
Why is that?
Because if it doesn't mingle with these, then everything must be true. But if it does mingle, then false belief comes to be, and false discourse, for to believe or say things that are not, that I take it, is falsehood arising in thought and in speech.
Just so.
And where falsehood is, there is deception.
Yes.
And where deception is, everything must at once be full of images and likenesses and appearance.
Of course.
And we said the sophist had taken refuge in just this territory, but then flatly denied that falsehood exists at all, on the grounds that no one can even think or say what is not, since what is not has no share whatsoever in being.
That's what we said.
But now this has been shown to have a share in being, so that on that score he presumably won't fight us any longer. But he might well say instead that some of the forms partake of what is not, and others don't. And that discourse and belief are among those that don't partake of it, so that he'd fight all over again for the image-making and appearance-making art, which we say he belongs to, claiming it doesn't exist at all, on the grounds that belief and discourse have no communion with what is not. Since if that communion isn't established, falsehood is altogether non-existent. For this reason, then, we must first track down what discourse, belief, and appearance actually are, so that once they come into view, we may see their communion with what is not, and having seen it, prove that falsehood exists, and having proved that, bind the sophist up in it, if indeed he's guilty of it, or else release him and go hunting in some other kind.
It really does seem true, stranger, what was said at the start about the sophist, that his kind is hard to hunt down. He seems positively stuffed with problems, and whenever he throws one out, we first have to fight our way through it before we can even get to the man himself. Just now we barely managed to force our way through the claim that what is not is not, and now another problem has been thrown down, and we have to prove that falsehood exists, both in discourse and in belief, and after that perhaps another, and after that one still another. There seems to be no end in sight, ever.
One should take heart, Theaetetus, if one is able to make even a little headway. What could a man who loses heart in matters like these do in others, if he either makes no progress in them or is even pushed back? Such a man, as the saying goes, will hardly ever take a city. But now, my friend, since we've gotten through what you mentioned, the biggest wall of all has in effect been taken. The rest from here on is easier and smaller.
Well said.
Let's first take up discourse and belief, as I just said, so that we can reckon more clearly whether what is not touches them, or whether both are altogether true and neither is ever false.
Right.
Come then, just as we spoke about the forms and the letters, let's examine names in the same way again. That seems to be the direction in which our present inquiry points.
Then, what exactly must we look into concerning names?
Whether all of them fit together with one another, or none do, or some are willing to while others aren't.
That much is clear. Some are willing, some aren't.
Perhaps you mean something like this, that words spoken in sequence and expressing something fit together, while those that signify nothing by their continuity don't fit.
What do you mean by that?
What I thought you'd already grasped and agreed to. For we have, I think, two kinds among the vocal expressions that concern being.
How so?
One kind is called names, the other verbs.
Explain each.
The sign that applies to actions we call, I think, a verb.
Yes.
And the vocal sign set upon the very things that perform those actions is a name.
Exactly so.
So a statement can never be made out of names alone strung together, nor again out of verbs spoken without names.
I don't follow that.
Clearly you agreed just now with something else in mind, since what I meant to say was just this, that a string of words spoken this way is not a statement.
How do you mean?
Take walks, runs, sleeps, and all the other verbs that signify actions, even if you say every one of them in a row, no statement results.
No, of course not.
And again, when someone says lion, deer, horse, and all the names given to those who perform such actions, no statement is put together by that kind of string either. In neither case do the sounds spoken indicate any action or inaction or the being of what is or of what is not until someone mixes verbs in with the names. Then they fit together, and the very first combination becomes a statement at once, pretty much the first and shortest of statements.
What do you mean by that?
When someone says man learns, do you say this is a statement, the shortest and first one?
I do.
Because at that point it indicates something about things that are or are coming to be or have come to be or are going to be. It doesn't just name something but achieves something by weaving verbs together with names. That's why we say he speaks rather than merely names, and it's to this weaving that we gave the name statement.
Right.
So then, just as some things fit together with each other and some don't, likewise with the signs of speech, some don't fit, but those that do fit produce a statement.
Exactly.
Now one more small point.
What is it?
A statement, whenever it occurs, must necessarily be a statement of something. It can't fail to be of something.
Just so.
And mustn't it also be of some particular quality?
How could it not?
Let's pay close attention to ourselves now.
We must.
I'll speak a statement to you, combining a thing with an action by means of a name and a verb, and you tell me what it's about.
I'll do that as best I can.
Theaetetus sits. Surely that's not a long statement.
No, a modest one.
It's your job now to say what it's about and whose it is.
Clearly it's about me, and it's mine.
And what about this one?
Which one?
Theaetetus, with whom I am now conversing, flies.
That one too. No one could say it's about anything or anyone but me.
We say each statement must be of some particular quality.
Yes.
So what quality must we assign to each of these two?
One false, I suppose, and the other true.
And the true one states the things that are, as they are, about you.
Of course.
While the false one states things other than the things that are.
Yes.
So it states things that are not as though they are.
Pretty much.
But it states them as being different things that are about you. For we said that many things that are true of each thing, and many that are not.
Exactly right.
Now the second statement I made about you, first of all, from what we determined a statement to be, it's necessarily one of the shortest possible.
We just agreed to that.
And second, it's of something.
Yes.
And if it isn't of you, it's of nothing else at all.
Of course not.
And if it were of nothing, it wouldn't be a statement at all. We showed that a statement being of nothing was impossible.
Quite right.
So being said about you, but saying different things as though they were the same, and things that are not as though they are a combination of this kind, made up of verbs and names, really and truly turns out to be a false statement.
Most true.
Now then, thought, judgment, and appearance. Isn't it already clear that these all arise in our souls, both false and true alike?
How so?
You'll see it more easily this way if you first grasp what each of them is and how they differ from one another.
Just give me the account.
Thought and statement are the same thing, except that the inner dialogue of the soul with itself, occurring without sound, That very thing is what we've named thought.
Quite so.
And the stream from that which goes out through the mouth with sound is called statement.
True.
And further, we know that statements contain what? Affirmation and denial.
We know that.
So when this occurs in the soul, silently, according to thought, is there anything you could call it besides judgment?
How could there be?
And when it's present in someone not on its own but through perception, could that condition rightly be called anything other than appearance?
Nothing else.
So then, since statement was shown to be true and false, and among these, thought turned out to be the soul's own dialogue with itself, judgment the conclusion of thought, and what we call appearance a blend of perception and judgment, it follows necessarily that, being akin to statement, some of these two are at times false.
Of course.
Do you see, then, that false judgment and false statement were found earlier than we expected, when we were afraid just now that we might be undertaking an utterly hopeless task in searching for it?
I see.
Let's not lose heart, then, about what remains either. Now that these things have come to light, let's recall the divisions we made earlier by kind.
Which ones?
We divided image-making into two kinds, the likeness-making kind and the appearance-making kind.
Yes.
And we said we were at a loss which of the two to place the sophist in.
That's right.
And while we were at a loss over that, an even greater dizziness poured over us, when the argument appeared that disputes against everyone, saying that no likeness or image or appearance exists at all, because falsehood never in any way, at any time, anywhere exists.
What you say is true.
But now, since statement has been shown to exist, and judgment has been shown to be capable of falsehood, there's room for there to be imitations of things that are, and for an art of deception to arise from this condition.
There is room.
And that the sophist was one or the other of these two, we had already agreed earlier.
Yes.
Let's try again, then, splitting the proposed kind in two, and proceeding always along the right-hand part of what's been cut, keeping hold of the sophist's company, until, having stripped away everything he shares with others and left behind his own proper nature, we display it first to ourselves, and then to those most naturally suited to this kind of method.
Right.
Well then, didn't we start by dividing productive art and acquisitive art?
Yes.
And under acquisitive art, he appeared to us in hunting, in contests, in trade, and in certain kinds like these.
Quite so.
But now that the imitative art has closed around him, clearly productive art itself must first be divided in two. For imitation is surely a kind of production of images, though we say not of the things themselves in each case. Isn't that so?
Absolutely.
Let productive art then first have two parts.
Which two?
The divine and the human.
I haven't yet understood.
Productive art, if we remember what was said at the start, we called every power that is responsible for things not previously existing coming to be afterward.
We remember.
All mortal living things, then, and plants too, whatever grows on earth from seeds and roots, and whatever soulless bodies form in the earth, meltable and unmeltable, shall we say these come to be afterward, not having existed before, through the craftsmanship of anyone but a god, or using the belief and language of the majority.
Which is that?
That nature generates them from some spontaneous cause, growing without thought, or that they come to be through reason and divine knowledge, proceeding from a god.
Perhaps because of my age, I often shift back and forth between the two opinions. But right now, looking at you, and supposing that you believe they come to be by a god's doing, I've come to believe that too myself.
Well said, Theaetetus, and if we thought you were one of those who in time to come would judge otherwise, we would now try, through argument backed by necessary persuasion, to make you agree. But since I can see your nature, that even without arguments from us, it will move on its own toward the very position you now say you're drawn to, I'll let it be. Time would be wasted for nothing. Instead, I'll take it that the things said to be by nature are made by divine craft, and the things composed out of these by human beings are made by human craft, and according to this account, there are two kinds of production, the one human, the other divine.
Right.
Now cut each of the two in half again.
How?
As if you were cutting the whole of productive art before along its breadth, and now again along its length.
Consider it cut.
So then there come to be four parts of it in all, two on our side, human, and two again on the God's side, divine.
Yes.
And divided the other way, one part from each of the two divisions is a making of the things themselves, while the remaining two might best be called image-making, and so productive art is again divided in two along these lines.
Tell me how each divides again.
We ourselves, I take it, and the other living things, and the things out of which natural things are made, fire and water and their kin, we know that all of these are, each of them, brought about as products of a god. Isn't that so?
So it is.
And attending upon each of these are images, not the things themselves, and these two have come about by a kind of divine contrivance.
Such as what?
The images in dreams and all the apparitions said to arise naturally in the daytime, a shadow, whenever darkness arises within firelight, and the doubled image, whenever a thing's own light and a foreign light come together as one around bright, smooth surfaces and produce an appearance that gives a sense contrary to our ordinary way of seeing.
Yes, for these are two works of divine production, the thing itself and the image that accompanies each thing.
And what of our own art? Shall we not say that it makes a house itself by house building, but by painting makes another sort of thing, a kind of man-made dream produced for people who are awake?
Quite so.
And likewise all the rest in pairs are twofold products of our productive activity. The thing itself, we say, by an art of direct production, and the image by an art of image-making.
Now I understand better, and I'll set down two kinds of production, each divided in two, divine and human, by the one cut, and by the other, one part of each being the thing itself, the other the offspring of certain likenesses.
Let's recall then that of the image-making art one kind was to be the likeness-making, the other the appearance-making, if falsehood, being truly falsehood, should turn out to be one of the things that are, by its very nature.
So it was.
And it did turn out so, and because of this we can now count these as two kinds, beyond dispute.
Yes.
Now let's divide image-making itself into two again.
How?
One kind happens through instruments, the other by the maker offering his own body as the instrument for producing the likeness.
What do you mean?
When someone uses his own body to make it resemble your shape, or his voice to make it sound like your voice, that particular sort of image making is generally called imitation.
Yes.
Let's mark this off and call it the imitative branch of image making, and let the rest go. We'll be lazy about it, and leave it to someone else to gather into one and give a fitting name.
Let's divide off the one, and drop the other.
But this too, Theaetetus, deserves to be thought of as double, see why.
Go on.
Of those who imitate, some know what they're imitating, others don't. And what division could we set up bigger than the one between knowing and not knowing?
None.
Now the case just mentioned was imitation by people who know. Someone could only imitate your shape and you yourself by recognizing you.
Of course.
But what about the shape of justice and of virtue as a whole? Don't a great many people, without knowing it but with some opinion about it, throw themselves eagerly into making it appear that they possess what they merely believe they have, imitating it as hard as they can in both deed and word?
Yes, a great many indeed.
And do all of them fail to seem just when they aren't just at all, or is it quite the opposite?
Quite the opposite.
So we should call this one a different kind of imitator from the other, the ignorant one as distinct from the knowing one.
Yes.
Then where will each of them get a fitting name? Or is it obviously hard because it seems some ancient laziness and lack of reflection kept earlier thinkers from even attempting to divide kinds into their forms, which is exactly why names aren't readily available for us either. Still, even if it's a bold thing to say, for the sake of distinguishing them, let's call imitation joined with opinion, opinion imitation, and the kind joined with knowledge, some sort of knowledge-based imitation.
Agreed.
Well, it's the first one we need. The sophist wasn't among those who know, but precisely among those who imitate.
Quite so.
Let's examine this opinion imitator, then, the way you'd examine a piece of iron, to see whether he's sound or still has some flaw running through him.
Let's examine him.
Well, he has a considerable flaw. One kind of him is simple-minded, thinking he knows the very things he only has opinions about. The other kind, because of all his tumbling about in arguments, is full of suspicion and fear that he's ignorant of the very things he has postured before others as knowing.
There certainly is a kind of each that you've described.
So shall we call the one a simple imitator and the other an ironic imitator?
That seems reasonable.
And of this second one, shall we say his kind is one or two?
You look and see.
I'm looking, and two distinct types appear to me. I can make out one who is capable of playing the ironist in public, before crowds, in long speeches, and another who does it privately, in short speeches, forcing the person he's talking with to contradict himself.
Quite right.
Then what shall we declare the one who talks at length to be? A statesman or a popular speaker?
A popular speaker.
And what shall we call the other one, wise or a sophist?
Well, wise is impossible, since we've established that he doesn't actually know. But since he's an imitator of the wise man, clearly he'll get some name derived from that one. And I think I've now more or less learned that we must truly call him that very person, the sophist through and through.
So shall we bind his name together as before, weaving it from end to beginning?
By all means.
The imitative part of the contradiction-making branch of the ironic side of the opinion-based part of the image-making kind, that portion of human, not divine, production which is marked off within speeches as the wonder-working branch, whoever says that this lineage and blood is where the true sophist comes from will, it seems, be saying the truest thing.
Absolutely.